Welcome, everyone. Today we're diving into some really interesting sources looking at, well, the current state of Christianity. And these aren't just simple observations. They offer a pretty devastating critique, but also maybe a radical vision for its spiritual future.
That's right. These sources, they're walking a fine line. They basically argue that the faith, you know, as an institution today, it's suffering. Suffering from a kind of spiritual dryness because it's lost touch with Jesus' original uncompromised teaching.
Uncompromised teachings, okay.
Yeah, the core diagnosis they give is that the religion has become heavily paganized and socialized. That's their term.
Paganized and socialized. Wow, that's a pretty fundamental claim, isn't it? Are they suggesting we need to, like, hit reset on the whole theology?
Not exactly a reset, more like a fundamental reorientation.
Yeah.
They see this current time as a crucial transitional period. Definitely challenging, you know, lots of rebellion against old superstitions, materialism creeping in. But they also see huge potential in this moment for real social change, moral renewal, maybe even spiritual enlightenment. If it works, it could genuinely shift global civilization towards, well, more transcendent values.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we jump to the cure they're proposing, we really need to get a handle on the problem itself. What exactly is this infection, this paganization and socialization? How did it happen, according to their blueprint?
Well, first off, it's interesting. They're actually careful not to just throw out the entire history. They acknowledge what they call the inestimable value of the spiritual heritage. You know, that continuous stream of truth that somehow kept flowing, even through really materialistic and secular times. So the idea isn't to erase the past.
Right, not erasure, but refinement.
Exactly, refine.
So the good stuff, the truth, it's still in there somewhere, but maybe buried under other things. They want us to keep the core truth, but appropriately reject superstitious accretions. That sounds tricky. How do they draw that line between heritage and, well, contamination?
Yeah, it really comes down to the source material, its purity. The main problem, they insist, is that modern Christianity languishes. It lacks a fresh vision. And why? Because it's undergone this significant paganization and socialization throughout its history. It became a social and cultural movement.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of drawing purely from the original source, it started pulling water from what they colorfully call ancient pagan swamps and barbarian morasses.
Whoa, hold on. Ancient pagan swamps, that's quite the image. Are they basically saying that as the church grew, it just absorbed stuff from the cultures around it, stuff that wasn't spiritual?
That's exactly it. The sources argue the faith got diluted, kind of polluted, by mixing with those existing cultural forms. Instead of staying true, exclusively sourced from the high Galilean tablelands, as they put it.
Okay, Galilean tablelands. For anyone listening who isn't familiar, is that like a literal place or is it more of a metaphor?
Oh, definitely a metaphor.
Yeah, for what exactly?
For the purity of the original message.
Yeah.
You know, the simple, direct teachings Jesus gave his first followers in Galilee. Before everything got written down into complex doctrines or mix up with Roman imperial culture or later barbarian customs, that socialization part means the core spiritual mission got watered down. Because it had to fit in with all these existing, often non-spiritual social habits.
Ah, okay. That makes sense of the slow death they talk about then. They list all these threats, don't they? Formalism, over-organization, intellectualism, other non-spiritual trends.
Yeah, and those trends, they basically make the organization turn inward. Formalism, you know, it creates bureaucracy. Rules become more important than actual spiritual feeling. Over-organization means everyone's just focused on keeping the institution running, maintaining itself.
So the institution starts serving its own survival.
Right, instead of its original purpose.
That sounds incredibly familiar, even outside religion. You see that in companies, governments.
Yeah.
The mission gets lost in the machinery. And they have some particularly strong words for mixing faith with money and power, right? Calling involvement in commerce and politics a flagrant betrayal of the master.
They see it as the ultimate compromise. If the whole point of the faith is something transcendent, something beyond this world,
yeah,
then getting tangled up in temporary, often self-serving earthly power games, that just fundamentally undermines the message's integrity. The moment a religion starts chasing worldly success or political clout, they argue, it loses its real power to change anything spiritually.
But hang on, hasn't some level of engagement with politics and, you know, the practical world been necessary for any big movement to actually have an impact? Are these sources saying completely withdraw? Or is it about the priority, getting sucked into the worldly stuff over the spiritual?
It's definitely about the prioritization, but they do push it further. They strongly believe that real lasting change, can only happen if the spiritual transformation comes first. They'd say the institution's job is spiritual regeneration, period. Trying to fix politics or economics before that spiritual foundation is solid. It's basically doomed because the core is already compromised.
Okay, that really sets up this crucial pivot point in the sources, doesn't it? This distinction they make between the religion of Jesus and the religion about Jesus. And they're saying what we desperately need now is the first one, a direct connection with Jesus himself, not just more complex systems about him.
Yes, this is absolutely central to their whole vision. The sources hammer this point. The life of Jesus itself, it's, you know, striking beauty, how seamlessly human and divine it was. It's transcendent simplicity, that life is the most powerful spiritual message there is, full stop.
So if the life itself is the message,
yeah,
then all the complex theology, the creeds, the doctrines, they actually become obstacles. That feels like dismissing centuries of really deep thinking.
Well, they don't dismiss thinking itself, but maybe its application.
Yeah.
Their point is, once you really grasp the simplicity and power of that life, theologians, philosophers, everyone should see how inappropriate it is to build these rigid boxes, these creeds and theological systems that try to contain something that should be liberating and alive. The creeds risk becoming a substitute for actually experiencing it yourself. Secondhand faith.
The complexity becomes a kind of safety net, which ties into that really interesting psychological point they make that smart people are often actually afraid of powerful religion.
Yeah, they fear being dominated by it.
Yeah.
So instead of surrendering to the spiritual demands, what do? They try to rationalize, traditionalize, and institutionalize it.
Yeah.
Basically, they try to tame it, domesticate it, make it something manageable, man-made, and man-dominated that they think they can control.
And maybe that fear isn't entirely unfounded, because the real deal, the religion of Jesus, it does ask for a lot, doesn't it?
It asks for everything, really. Total dedication to finding the Father's will, and then pouring your energy into unselfish service for others, the brotherhood of man. The sources are pretty blunt here. Selfish men and women simply will not pay such a price. They don't avoid the religion because they don't believe it. They avoid it because they're scared of what it demands, what it might do to their comfortable, self-focused lives.
Okay. Here's where it gets really interesting, because if the existing institutions, the about Jesus' structures, are failing because of these built-in compromises, then the real change has to come from somewhere else, right? From the ground up, moving beyond that secondhand faith. So who leads this kind of spiritual revolution?
The sources are clear. They call for new leaders. Spiritual men and women, they say, who will dare to depend solely on Jesus and his incomparable teachings. And their focus has to be laser sharp. Spiritual regeneration first, not fixing the institution, not social reform as the primary goal. When these spirit-born souls, as they call them, emerge, they believe the right kind of reorganization will naturally follow from that spiritual energy.
That's a key point. It starts with individuals, not structures. And they specifically warn against just trying to, like, copy early Christianity, right? No historical cosplay.
Right. They call that futile.
Yeah.
Spiritual progress means moving forward. You need the light of a new revelation of Jesus's life, a fresh understanding of his original gospel applied now. You can't just rewind the clock. The future has to be built on the past's foundation, sure, but adapted for today's world.
So the emphasis has to be on living it out, which brings us back to that firsthand versus secondhand idea.
Exactly. The world doesn't need more theories. It needs living demonstrations of Jesus through the transformed lives of spirit-born individuals. Until someone has that personal experiential discovery of God's presence within them, that firsthand religion, everything else is just, well, exalted humanism. Just nice ideas, high-minded philosophy. It's that direct experience that conquers the spiritual dryness they diagnose.
And they offer a really clear, almost simple measuring stick for this genuine, life-changing faith. It's that metaphor, the second mile.
Yes. The second mile, that's the mark of real discipleship. The first mile, they explain, is just doing what you have to do. Compulsion, duty, following the rules, meeting expectations. Most conventional religion, they'd say, manages the first mile. People show up, they follow the customs.
Right. You check the box, fulfill the basic obligation, keep up appearances.
Exactly. But that second mile, that's different. It's free service and liberty-loving devotion. It's not about having to do something. It's about wanting to. It's that spontaneous reaching out in love, the Jesusonian, as they put it, grasping his brother in pure love, going way beyond what any rule or social pressure demands.
It's like doing something extra in a friendship, not because you owe them, but just because you care. That's the second mile. And the really sobering part of their analysis is that humanity is basically languishing and stumbling along in moral darkness because there are just so few genuine second milers around.
It's not a lack of information. It's a lack of that deep, overflowing devotion, the kind of devotion that makes you want to go beyond duty. That's where the transformation really happens.
Okay, let's shift to the end game then. If this kind of spiritual renaissance happens, if people really focus on the original teachings, the sources predict a massive cultural shift, right?
Oh, yeah, they paint a picture of destiny. They see this revitalized religion of Jesus destined to conquer an empire of materialistic secularism. And not just conquer, but overthrow a world sway of mechanistic naturalism from its dominant position in culture.
Mechanistic naturalism. Okay, that's a bit of philosophical jargon. Can we break that down? What does that mean in everyday terms for someone listening?
Sure. It basically refers to that widespread modern view that the universe is just a big machine. No inherent purpose, no meaning, no spiritual force behind it all. Everything just boils down to physical laws, chance, random forces.
Meaningless, essentially.
Pretty much. So the triumph they're talking about isn't just winning an argument. It's about culturally replacing that sense of meaninglessness with a sense of transcendent purpose, a recognition that there's a spiritual reality, overthrowing pessimism, really.
So only a spiritual revival has the power to displace that purely materialist view. And the sources are really strict about the sequence here, aren't they? Spiritual first, then social order.
It's an absolutely essential principle for them. True spiritual revival must come first. It precedes and grounds any effective social, moral, economic, or political improvement. If you try to fix the politics or the economy first, you're just slapping a band-aid on what is fundamentally a spiritual problem. It won't hold.
Which brings us right back to the institutional problem they started with all the different denominations, the infighting, the way it fragments the message. How can the spiritual unity they envision possibly emerge from today's reality, which seems so divided?
Well, they define the true church, what they call the Jesus Brotherhood, as something invisible, something spiritual, and its defining feature is unity, but crucially not uniformity. Uniformity where everyone has to look the same, believe exactly the same things in the same way, act the same way, that's a feature of the physical world, of rigid systems.
Okay, so spiritual unity is different. It comes from
what?
A shared connection.
Exactly. It's the result, the fruit, of a shared faith union with the living Jesus. That implies you could have lots of different ways of expressing that faith, different organizations even. They could coexist as long as the core devotion, the source, is singularly focused on those uncompromised teachings of the master.
So the real enemy isn't diversity of practice, it's the rivalry.
Precisely. Sectarian rivalry, group bitterness, claiming we have the only truth. That's the chief obstacle. And it's especially damaging when trying to share the message globally.
Right, because people in other cultures, say, in the East, they don't necessarily see a unified message from Jesus. They see the messy, fragmented Western cultural movement that developed about Jesus.
They see all the historical baggage, the internal conflict.
All the first mile stuff, maybe, but not the unified second mile spirit.
Exactly. They see fragmentation, which doesn't look like transcendent truth. But the flip side is, the potential here is huge. The idea of a new, transformed human society built on the spiritual rebirth of this brotherhood. That, they say, should thrill all who believe in him. It's an adventure.
So what does this all mean? Taking a step back, the big takeaway here seems to be this dramatic shift in focus. Away from institutions, away from complex theology, and back to the radical, life-changing simplicity of one person's life and his core teachings.
Yeah, that sums it up well. And while they acknowledge institutional Christianity has done a lot of good service over the centuries, the big challenge now is how it's perceived. It often gets identified, especially globally, with the flaws of Western civilization itself, you know, seen as part of a system that tolerates science without idealism, politics without principles, wealth without work, pleasure without restraint, and that whole list, the solution they propose, it's a humble return back to the core living gospel, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Simple, but profound.
And there's one final, really thought-provoking piece at the end about how even things outside of religion could actually help lay the groundwork for this. Secular education, for instance.
Right. They suggest that secular education could play a surprisingly positive role if it shifted its focus a bit. If it taught young people more about life planning and character progression, if it emphasized moral discipline instead of constantly pushing self-gratification.
So secular education could build the foundation, the self-control, the character.
Exactly. It could help cultivate a more disciplined person, someone who has the groundwork, the moral structure, ready to receive the spiritual motivation later. Someone prepared, maybe, to understand the cost and the value of going that second mile.
Is our current educational focus sometimes working against building that foundational discipline needed for any kind of deep spiritual life? That is definitely something to mull over.